present the news quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Welcome to the news quiz. We start with a cutting from The Telegraph, read by Corrie Caulfield.
Bond girls make fleeting appearances early in the films and usually end up in bed with 007. Their amorous exploits all too often lead them to a sticky end.
Well, our thanks to Mike Gledhill in Switzerland for sending in that muck. We've got a number of very special people here. This is a slice of history. A group called James Shepherd Versatile Brass, who recorded the theme tune for this very series. 1974 it was recorded. In 1977 it was first used, and at the end of this year, Versatile Brass, they will play their last ever gig. They don't know that. I've just decided it. Some representatives, Nigel, Helen and David, current members of Versatile Brass, are here. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome them. Are you going to give us a toot?
Sorry.
I didn't know you were a connoisseur, Miles.
I've got a grade 5 theory. I'm pretty sure that's what they're called. Is what I call a toot. Super. Now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Jeremy Hardy and Rebecca Front. And opposite them, on my left, Camilla Long and Romesh Ranganathan. Jeremy, who has been grounded for their own good?
Lots of British people in Egypt. And if you are listening in Egypt, journalists will descend on you and ask you what your journey is like and try and set it in context. Don't be saying, it's been absolute hell. We've been waiting for 4 hours. We've been backwards and forwards to the shop to get water, and we need the lavatory, and one of the cubicles is blocked. Just set it in context. It'll be a great story when you get back, because no one wants to hear that you've had a great time. You know, you get back from holiday and say it was great, everyone goes, oh, God, really? People don't care. People want to know that you've lost your luggage or been taken hostage. That's an interesting holiday story. Being caught up in a terrorist incident is quite good. You can put that on Facebook. People will care.
I want to know how many people are actually walking home, because that's what I would do. I wouldn't trust a plane out of Sharm el-Sheikh for the next 6 months.
No.
I would be properly walking up to Tunisia or...
well, we've got a rambler on the panel.
I've no idea. Isn't Cameron sorting it out, though? Isn't
yeah.
He? Cameron's sending a pack of hounds to guide people home.
the problem is, they're sort of saying about a plucky Brit stuck out there, whatever, but then they get a photo of them, and the most recent photo is them on holiday, so they just look massively happy. You're stuck on holiday. That's pretty sweet, right?
Yeah.
I don't understand why people are annoyed. I understand it's an emergency if you run out of sun cream or something, but otherwise, just dig in, mate. Have a great time.
What's extraordinary is there are 20,000 people for the British who aren't here at the moment who are actually in Egypt. And did we notice? And yet, 20,000 Syrian people being brought here over the next 4 years is an absolutely massive deal for the government.
20,000 people, that is the exact population of Truro, if you want to know what...
Yeah, but that's probably not all of them. They're probably a random sampling of people from all over the country. I don't think Truro's ground to a halt, because everyone thought, do you know what, we just don't spend enough time together here in this small Cornish town. Let's all go on holiday together as well.
Maybe there's a big story as to why the whole of Truro has been evacuated to Sharm el-Sheikh. Maybe we're missing something here.
Are you from Truro? Is it quiet? Do write in. Now, who might be responsible?
No one here, I shouldn't think. Well, okay, the Russians thought that they would... I mean, the irony is the Russians didn't even go into Syria to attack ISIS. They went in to attack the Free Syrian Army to keep Assad in power, but it's all rebounded on them because they accidentally managed to take out some ISIS guys at the same time. And so there is an affiliate group in the Sinai among Bedouin who are very badly treated by the Egyptian tyranny. But the Yemen Sisi is very upset with us because we have damaged, by telling our, you know, it's too dangerous to be in Egypt, so stay there, is the instruction to our holiday makers. By telling them that, we are actually damaging the tourism industry because, bizarrely, the military dictatorship has done nothing to dent British people's enthusiasm for going there.
So why is it unfortunate timing?
Because Sisi's here.
He's arrived.
How did he get here?
He's been on the coming along walking route.
He's here with David Cameron because we sell tons of arms to Egypt, essentially. So David Cameron has had a bit of a red-faced experience. Well, President Sisi, which frankly is not the greatest name for a warmonger.
What is a great name for a warmonger?
Not Sisi.
Okay.
It's like we get a new new dictator visiting every month at the moment, don't we? We just cleared up from the Chinese being over here. Now we've got the Egyptians over here buying our bombs. At least we're not giving them our power stations, I suppose. What do we sell them, then, in terms of weaponry?
We sell them components for military combat vehicles, about 40 million quid's worth. You just sort of think, well, there's this sort of, like, diplomatic kind of vacuum where they come over here and these terrible things are happening and nobody is talking about them, nobody is acknowledging the fact that a sort of terrorist group has probably blown this plane out of the sky. And it's just all grinning all the way to Downing Street and no one is talking about it. And I think it's hugely dishonest of Philip Hammond, the Foreign Secretary, to get up and pretend that we don't think all of these events are linked.
Is he going to be angry about this Sharm el Sheikh, you know, the shutting the flights down? Isn't he gonna, that's gonna
oh,
be
well, we'll find out, I'm sure.
Well, David Cameron's going to have to tell him that the security's too lax for them to have flights going out there. You know, how do you bring that up? Do you sort of say, do you notice how rigid security was when you came over here, Sisi?
Yes.
Get the hint, mate.
Is he going to leave?
He's got to be allowed to leave, hasn't he? I mean, we can't have a sort of... What's the WikiLeaks chap? I mean, we can't have these sorts of things on our hands continually, just sort of tyrannical. I'm not comparing the two like
well,
for
got,
like.
Well, he could hold up in his own embassy, couldn't he?
Oh, that's true,
Because
yeah.
that's, strictly speaking, Egyptian territory, isn't it?
And I hear that they've got a fold-out. Disconcertingly, this is the news that the UK government temporarily suspended flights from the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh following a suspected terrorist attack. The world awaits the response of Vladimir Putin to recent events in Egypt, which one assumes will be measured and temperate. Well, although, if you've always wanted to see the pyramids, you may well have missed your chance. All Thomas Cook flights to and from Sharm el-Sheikh have been cancelled until the 12th of November, and on Thursday, EasyJet cancelled all its flights to and from the region. Ryanair flights are also severely disrupted. Nothing to do with the situation in Egypt. They really are... really are just awful.
Obviously, so their planes are quite safe because you have to pay so much for extra baggage.
All this comes as Britain prepares to welcome Egypt's President Sisi. Despite some protests, we're planning to extend the traditional welcome, greeting him with a red carpet, treating him to dinner with the Queen, and finally waving him off with a significant amount of our national infrastructure. I should just say that this is a story that is developing all the time and may well have been resolved by the time we go on air. Although I realise those words may seem hollow if you're listening to this programme on iPlayer in the departure lounge of Sharm el-Sheikh Airport on Saturday next week. 2 points to Jeremy. Rebecca, have a listen to this.
You can never have too little of the Electric Light Orchestra, can you?
Rebecca, who may be listening to your calls?
Theresa May, herself. Personally, maybe listening because we're about to give her permission to do that. She's been addressing the House of Commons this week about the Investigatory Powers Bill, which is a sort of snooper's charter, Mark II. Basically, they want to extend powers of surveillance in quite a sort of massively draconian way. And very significantly, when she was talking to Parliament this week, she revealed what we all knew anyway, that MI5 and so on have been listening into phone calls and intercepting emails for a very, very long time anyway. But on top of that, they want to extend this to much greater powers, and they want to insist that the internet companies and the phone companies have to keep hold of everybody's email records, phone records, and sort of internet browsing up to a point, or at least the web pages that you visit, for a year. Internet companies like, for example, TalkTalk.
They say the difference between content and data. So you don't need to worry, even though the police, without a warrant, can check that you might have gone on a website called donkeybondagelarks.com, they won't know the particular saddles that you showed interest in.
What's ridiculous about this is so much of it is completely trivial and completely unnecessary. Who is going to police the policers? Who is going to
There are people that can veto ministers.
Well, a sort of crack panel of judges. Well, sorry, I don't think that's good enough. We don't know who the judges are going to be. We
Simon
don't know what
Cowell.
Yeah, exactly.
I think my issue with this is I don't think it goes far enough. because I think we should be looking at content. You know, I think if you're one of these people that, you know, on Facebook puts up that Marilyn Monroe quote that says, if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my best. I think you should be called into MI5 and just given a talking to. People that put up vague things like, why do bad things happen to good people? Inviting the reply, you OK, hum? You need to go to MI5, all right? You go straight away.
If GCHQ are supposed to be so computer savvy, why can't they just access their own porn without having to go trawling through other people? I love the way they said, it's just a little tidying up exercise. Nothing to worry. It's like when a medical professional says, it's just a tiny scratch before plunging a sharp metal object into your buttock. It's just a little tidying up thing. It's just some clumsy people have left some emails lying around and some personal private information. We're just going to tidy it up into this enormous silo and then look at it and spend hours in our pants reading through your private correspondence.
I mean, has anyone got anything to hide?
Everyone's got stuff to hide.
I mean, for the last week, have spent a lot of time on the Butlins website. Because at a certain point around now, they dropped the Christmas break prices. And there you go, I've said it. You want to investigate me? Go ahead. I'm not scared. I think the best way to do it is when you log onto the internet, they tell you if you're being surveilled at that point. So when you go on and you're about to search for it, it says, we're watching
you. Well, you just have a window up at the top with somebody watching you.
Yeah, just like a face going, go on, mate, what are you going to search for?
Or a little Theresa May emoticon. Yeah.
Yeah. And a little gif where she just wags her finger. No. Naughty Ramesh, not Butlins again.
Furtively, this is the draft investigatory powers bill proposed by Home Secretary and demagogue in slingbacks Theresa May, allowing the intelligence services to scrutinise everyone's mobile phone records and internet histories and helping to make this country even more like a brutally repressive totalitarian regime, albeit one that enjoys impressively fast broadband speeds. Hello, Theresa, if you're listening. You certainly are to most things, except perhaps consensus. The moves have been dubbed a snooper's charter, but there are safeguards. A panel of specially trained retired judges will rule on police requests, because when it comes to the internet, there is no one better qualified and more up to the minute than not merely judges, but retired judges. I think some of them only sit near computers to keep warm. The government having access to people's internet records strikes some people as reminiscent of 1984, although I think it's fair to say that Orwell wasn't explicitly talking about the amount I happen to spend on organic truffle oil. Seriously, it really is worth paying more. 2 points to Rebecca. Ramesh, who's been unsuccessful in their hunt for a compromise?
This is the Jeremy Hunt versus doctors standoff. You know, I'll start off by saying it's very difficult for me to have any sympathy for the doctors because I spent my whole life with my mum telling me that I should have been one. This is all started from David Cameron's promise that we're going to get a 24/7 NHS, because as we all know, the NHS previously worked strictly to office hours. And so, thankfully, he's bringing this in. So we've got a situation where Jeremy Hunt has offered an 11% pay increase, which the BMA have rejected. Basically, what he wants to do is, he wants to deal with the issue of weekends. NHS weekends are not good. Not like, you know, to go away or whatever, but you don't do an NHS weekender. That's what I'm trying to say. But apparently, if you get admitted to a hospital on a Sunday, you're 16% more likely to die than if you go in on a Wednesday, which obviously solved the problem. Wait a few days. I mean, that seems... That seems like the easy... But he's trying to tackle that. That's what he's trying to do. And so he wants weekends to not be unsociable hours, you know, in terms of pay and stuff like that. And the argument is that he's just doing this to reduce wage bills. And so what the doctors have said is, or the BMA have said, is an 11% increase that you've offered us is disgusting, because actually that is a 26% decrease. And so they're having a standoff and they're balloting their members to take strike action. And as we're coming into the winter months, which is the NHS's hot time, a lot of people slipping over.
You said that in a very menacing way.
I like to keep the NHS ticking over, so I'll go out, slippery pavements, push a couple of people over just to keep them in trade.
I think the problem we have is cabinet ministers with no experience in what they're actually dealing with. And it's like you've got to have an education secretary with a teaching background, and you've got to have a health secretary who's alive.
The problem with this whole thing was actually not the pay, but the hours. And the fact that Jeremy Hunt had said to the junior doctors, well, we're going to give you an 11% pay rise, but you're going to have to do 30% more work on top of that.
Well, they've calculated how much more work people do when they're awake than when they're asleep. So they figure if they could just cut out all this sleeping nonsense.
I think it's quite nice to see strike action that is actually sort of feels like it's got public support, you know, because the tagline to this is that they're trying to destroy the NHS. And so, you know, I was a teacher and I was a union rep at my school, and I was in favour of strike action all the time, even when there weren't issues to discuss. I just thought... I'd always have friends of mine that worked in the private sector just criticising me, saying, you know, we're not behind you, not getting sympathy by striking. And this feels slightly different, you know, because Jeremy Hunt has handled it so spectacularly badly, and the doctors have sort of got this campaign together and are sort of organising it. Well, it feels different. It feels like they've got the public support in a way that other strikes haven't in the past.
What's really annoying for me is that me and Corbyn have been working so hard to convince people that the name Jeremy isn't the preserve of knobheads, but Clarkson and Hunt just undoing all the good work that we do.
Perplexingly, this is the latest pay offer to junior doctors made by Jeremy Hunt, Health Secretary. Hunt has offered junior doctors pay rises of up to 15% to avoid strike action, but they've rejected the offer, meaning that everyone in the country now has to decide who they trust more, millions of medical professionals or Jeremy Hunt. I know to whom I'd rather give a large sample of my still steaming urine. With these clumsy, slippy hands. The debate concerns changes to overtime and what constitutes the weekend, although I've always felt that if you wake up at a back street, bleeding profusely from the face, covered in vomit and with two broken legs, then you should be in hospital, and it is definitely the weekend. Doctors say that even though the offer is presented as a pay rise, the loss of overtime means it's still a pay cut. And if there is anyone who can spot bad news being dressed up as good, it's a doctor. These are, after all, people who are used to saying to their patients things like, you know, you used to complain about being on your feet all day. Well, not anymore. Cynics amongst us might suggest that this is a case of the Conservatives gradually weakening a public service organisation so that the electorate will eventually accept its privatisation. I wish I could think of another such example, but looking around, nothing... nothing really springs to mind. 2 points to Romesh. And at the end of round one, the scores are Jeremy and Rebecca have 5, and so too do Camilla and Romesh. We start round two with a cutting from the BBC website.
Due to insufficient funds, the first museum in Britain dedicated to the history of quilt making has folded.
Thanks to everyone who sent us that. Jeremy, who fears being defeated by his own rebels in order to defeat some other rebels?
Well, Cameron's backed down on bombing Syria because he won't be able to get the vote through. And he's already been humiliated once on it, and he doesn't like losing. And the idea that he might lose the vote again is more than he can bear. So he's not going to run this up the flagpole. A handful of Labour MPs might vote with him, but they would be balanced out by the Tories who would vote against. So, and it's a horrible situation, not to make light of Syria. It's an appalling regime, and ISIS are appalling, and it's a hideous nightmare. But The history of British involvement in the Middle East makes the Ottoman Empire look like a well-run local authority. I mean, Britain and America are absolute geniuses at making things in the Middle East worse. Not many people could have found something as vile as Saddam's Iraq and thought, no, we could mess it up a bit more.
I actually think you're being a bit generous to David Cameron, to be honest with you, Jeremy. I think that he wants a tasty little war under his belt before he leaves office, and I think...
Sorry, but I just think completely the opposite. I think there's a huge sense of... It's not funny, this, at all, but I just think there's probably a huge sense of relief that they've got a reason not to go in.
No, but not on David Cameron's part.
I think there might be. I just...
Well, why would he try?
Come back to haunt him, as it has with Blair, and I just think, you know, it's actually quite good if somebody else has made that decision.
These people are in such denial about these things. Because, you know, people are saying, well, the trouble is Iraq's poisoned the world, and blooming Iraq has spoiled everything. I mean, Iraq has given war a bad name, hasn't it? You know? I mean, before Iraq, people thought, war, what's not to like?
I found myself sort of reading, watching it, just being very grateful that it does have to go to a vote. It's a lot of pressure, isn't it, to have that decision in your hands. You know, I was like getting a sandwich and the person in front of me didn't decide what they wanted until they got to the front of the queue. And if I had sole access, I would have at least sent in ground troops. Like,
we used to have politicians who were people who had seen war. You know, whether it be, you know, Tony Benn or Jim Gelland or, you know, Heath, that generation, they'd all seen the Second World War. But now you've got a generation of people who grew up reading comics in which the enemy dies going, Aga her Himmel. And war is just a game to
it. By your theory, Jeremy, if people used to be, they'd fought in wars and then they became MPs, they had a better idea of it. I mean, really, what we need now, actually, then, is more wars now and conscription so that in 15 to 20 years' time, excellent MPs. Disconcertingly, the Foreign Affairs Committee has urged David Cameron not to press ahead with a vote on UK airstrikes in Syria. I'm sure we can all agree that after the doom and despair that we hear so much of in the news, it's a welcome relief to tuck into a more light-hearted subject. Cameron was considering military action against Islamic State, but concerns have been raised about the legality of any UK action in Syria. Although, given the Chilcot inquiry's ongoing imminent publication, there's a good chance that any investigation into Syria could well be completed minutes before every single one of us has turned to dust. The Prime Minister has said he will return to the Commons for a vote, but only when there is a clear consensus. Russia, meanwhile, are thoroughly committed to their own programme of airstrikes, although these were only authorised after an internal democratic debate involving a large number of Vladimir Putin's personalities. The government were, of course, defeated over Syrian airstrikes by Ed Miliband in 2013, as Ed Miliband's grandchildren will doubtless in due course be told over and over again, before asking what then happened in the general election and being sent abruptly to bed with no cookies or Chomsky. 2 points to Jeremy. Rebecca, why is making a phone call particularly taxing?
Oh, taxing. Oh, I see what you've done there. Mm-hmm. Yes. HMRC have come under the scrutiny of the Commons Public Accounts Committee. And some time ago, their customer service was rated by, I think, the same committee as being abysmal. It's now been rated as getting worse. Apparently, in the first half of this year, fewer than half of the calls that were made to its customer service helpline were answered. Funnily enough, this story came up at a very opportune moment because a friend of mine had been telling me that only this week she had got onto HMRC and rung out, and her call was answered. And she spoke to a very pleasant person on the phone and started to say, you know, I've been looking at your website and I've got a slight query. And this person said, I'm not competent to answer that question, I'm afraid. And my friend said, OK, you don't actually know what the question is yet. To which the person, all credit to them, said, no, but I do know I'm not competent to answer. There we are. That sort of tells you everything you need to know, I think, about HMRC and their... but, of course, it's a wider thing than this. That was specifically about their customer services. But also there has been yet more outcry about their significant failures in tracking down people who are sort of not paying their tax and hiding large amounts of money in offshore accounts. And apparently they were given an enormous number by a whistleblower at HSBC, weren't they? They were given a list of something like 3,500 people who had been evading tax by keeping their money in this secret bank account. And they've so far prosecuted one. So they're not doing terribly well, HMRC.
People have tried to say that this is part of the one problem, that their failure to answer the phone is in some way related to their inability to collect tax. So presumably, Philip Green was sort of on waited for 45 minutes. Oh, come on, I've got all this tax I want to pay. And then gives up. And his wife says, did you get through? He says, no, I couldn't get through to him. She says, oh, I'll tell you what, put the company in my name and I'll sort it out when I get to Monaco.
Do you think this news sort of plays into the hands of people like Google? They're like, we haven't been avoiding tax for 7 years. We've been on hold.
What I want to know is, if people are not picking up the phone, then where are our taxes going? It's a taxpayer-funded service.
Well, they've been cut. They've been cutting all the ones with the phone skills.
Well, they've been cutting because they've been collecting.
Well, no, but they've cut staff.
You need taxes to pay for them to answer the phones.
Yes, man.
But they're not,
not answering the phones because they're not
there.
Yeah,
but they're cutting...
It's chicken and egg, man. Yeah, yes. Like, it's doing my head in.
Ridiculous.
Well, actually, it's all going to be a lot simpler once they can just tap into your bank accounts and emails and everything. They'll know how much tax you owe anyway, won't they?
Well, so once... we become sort of cashless and everything is just done by sort of contacts and sort of digi thing. Actually, everything could just be entirely monitored. When you, once you can't sort of store suit... I'm onto something.
but you describe quite the utopia.
I often think that with Miles, that the inside of your head sort of is a little utopian fantasy, isn't it?
It's just a sort of wonderland where all admin is slightly less complicated. Doesn't that sound dreamy? Egregiously, this is the surprisingly poor quality of HMRC's hitherto excellent customer service. Apparently, the taxman now only manages to answer 50% of calls to its helpline, which is hampering the collection of tax, according to members of the Public Accounts Committee, meaning there are now three inevitable things in life: death, taxes, and praying for death while on hold trying to pay your taxes. HMRC has been forced to reduce its running costs from £3.4 billion to £3.1 billion over the past 5 years. If only there was some magical way of somehow taking a percentage of everyone's earnings and using some of that to cover the running costs. But who could fathom such a thing? Of 3,600 British people known to hide money in Switzerland, just one person was prosecuted. Yes, this is awful, but let's not be too harsh on these tax dodgers. Chances are they're this station's core demographic. We can't afford to lose any more to Classic FM. 2 points to Rebecca. Camilla, which ID has not received the quality stamp of approval?
This is about the new UK passport. A new passport has been issued, and the people on the passport, which I have never looked at, by the way, I didn't know there were people in your passport, but there are. There are pictures of people in the passport on the bits where they stamp.
That's
the kind
your
of...
photo, come on.
You're so rude. So the people in the passport. Romesh makes me laugh so much, and it's very odd.
You know the people aren't really in the passport, don't they? Like television, there's not little people in there, really.
If it's going to get you taken off a flight, you wonder, there's people in this passport. They're talking to me.
Go on.
So anyway, the people in the passport are... It's a subject of great feminist debate at the moment because most of them are men and only two of them are women, Ada Lovelace and Elizabeth Scott. And there's been an enormous amount of uproar because 2 out of 7 is not great. The fact that Giles Gilbert Scott, who is, I think, related to Elizabeth Scott, is also in the passport. And Anish Kapoor is in the passport and Anthony Gormley is in the passport. I think this is basically the weirdest dinner party anybody has ever been to. What I really loved was when the head of the passport agency was challenged about this and said, you know, why haven't you got Charlotte Bronte? Admittedly, one of our finest novelists, represented in your new creative England-Britain passport. He said, well, everybody, you know, wants someone from their favourite rock band or their local icon. And it's like,
have a slightly odd bit of insight to bring to the Charlotte Bronte question, or the Brontes generally, or Victorian novelists, because, of course, they could have had any of the Brontes.
Yeah.
They could have had Mrs. Gaskell.
You're not allowed to.
George Eliot. They could have had... What do you mean you're not allowed
no,
to?
Well, sorry. No.
I thought you meant you're not physically not allowed
no,
to.
No, the people in the passport said you can't.
That's what I meant.
But I've just finished filming a costume drama set in Victorian times, so I've been wearing mid-Victorian costume. So as if it weren't bad enough that you can't breathe and you can't eat and you can't sit back in a chair and you can't lie down, you've then got this crinoline, which also means that you can't see your feet, you're constantly tripping over, you can't get through doorways. So this is my experience of going through what the Brontes and Mrs. Gaskell and George Eliot. So to my mind, they deserve to have a page in that passport, not only because they wrote some of the finest novels in English literary history, but also because presumably they were able to go to the loo without peeing all over their shoes, which frankly is not something I have to confess that I managed to master.
I only look at my passport occasionally. I look at it once during our annual paperwork check at my house, and then the other.
What on earth is that?
That is every year, once a year, we make sure we know where all our important documents are.
To me, that just sounds dreamy. That sounds absolutely.
I just think that...
Probably 6 monthly in our house. But we're kind of a bit wilder.
But, yeah, I just don't understand. It's a weird thing to... You just don't look in your passport.
Yeah, but you've got to have something to read when you're in that endless snaking queue at Heathrow, haven't you? Because you can be there
for
hours
stuff,
at a time.
Put stuff in, like, yes, you do have to put liquids in plastic bags. Yes, you will have to show your boarding pass even if you're just buying a magazine. Like, useful information.
Or quiz questions. That
yeah,
could
that'd be
quite good.
Sudoku?
Yeah.
Yeah. Biometrically, these are the new British passports that contain pictures of prominent figures from British history. But of these prominent figures, 7 are men and only 2 are women. The Director General of the Passport Office said it wasn't something where we said, let's set out to only have 2 women. Presumably, he only set out to have 1, but got carried away. The 2 women featured in the passport are architect Elizabeth Scott and Ada Lovelace. Now, when I say I've never heard of them before, I don't want to sound sexist, especially as I've now had the chance to have a look at them both, and I have no hesitation in saying that they are a pair of right ruddy scorchers. Labour MP Emily Thornberry said, "This is an opportunity to celebrate the achievements of all women. Call me a feminist, and you wouldn't be the first, but... when it comes to celebrating the achievements of all women, I'm going to stick my neck out here and say putting some pictures in a passport may not even be enough." Two points to Camilla. Romesh, have a listen to this.
It's just one more day. No one said there would be rain again. Won't blame it on myself. Yeah, I'll blame it on the weatherman.
Romesh, why can we no longer blame it on the weatherman?
This is about the BBC's new sort of... It's called Weather Watchers. And what it is, it's an online weather club. And what happens in this club... don't all run off to join as I'm talking. But what happens is you basically join up with this club and you can submit your weather news, and then that all gets put into this central thing, and then you could be part of the BBC's weather report. You know, you could, if you've done a good one, you get incorporated into it. So again, like, I don't know, in Birmingham it's 8 degrees, but Susan says it's all right if you put a fleece on or something like that. That's kind of how it works. So basically, but the thing is, obviously you can't, they're not predicting the weather. What you're doing is looking outside and then go, it's cold. And taking a photo and then sending that. I mean, I don't know if this is just to annoy the people that are having to amass internet data, that they're going to have to look at all this. let's see what it's like outside Debbie's window. Oh. But that's the idea, basically.
I already get these kind of text updates on a regular basis from my dad, who is just by nature a weather watcher. So I get regular texts saying things like, it's a bit nippy out, put on a muffler. I'm going to have to take them much more seriously, I think. But what slightly worries me is, am I right in thinking that last August, the Met Office lost its contract with the BBC.
You are correct.
And the BBC said that they were outsourcing to find a more... You see where I'm going with this? I mean, is that it? Is that what we've got to look forward to?
It's the spirit of voluntarism, isn't it? It's this idea, we'll all just pitch in, the big society. I want dedicated professionals to tell me what the weather's going to be. I mean, you know, if I want to know the views of the ill-informed, I'll listen to any answers. I don't... My dad, who I barely saw growing up because he was at work all the time, designed all of this country's weather satellites. I don't want people ringing in the BBC saying, I've seen a cow sitting down, you know what that means.
To be fair, though, I would probably trust Rebecca's dad slightly more than the Met Office.
They're quite predicting.
The satellites from space that show the clouds and where they're moving and where... And you can see it all. You can tell what's going to happen.
But my dad's got quite a big window. And... And he's interested, that's the thing. You know, he cares.
Do you know when the weather first came out, when newspapers were first invented, they just used to put in yesterday's weather? So it's just a sort of nostalgia feature.
I think it sounds like a reality show. I think they're going to try and find the best weather predictor in Britain, and it will be something like the Great British Rain Off or something like that. And it will be amazing.
And how will that work? So you get them all in a tent.
Yes.
And then you say, what do you think will happen tomorrow?
Yeah, and then Mel and Sue arrive, and then Mary Berry comes. We're just going to get her in.
You think you should have cooking personalities, not weather personalities?
Cooking personalities. Are there any weather personalities?
Yeah, Michael Fish. Obviously, they'd get Michael Fish to be the Mary
Berry. Yeah, but he's not reliable, though, is he?
He made that one mistake.
Quite a big one, though, to be fair.
What that night like was like for him, just looking out the window going, oh,
as
God.
The house has collapsed.
Tomorrow is going to be an absolute nightmare.
I do hope no one was watching.
Everyone's got very excited about Carol Kirkwood. She's the sort of woman that my dad would call handsome.
She's the face of the new crowd-sourced Weather Club Britain.
Because she looks trustworthy. You would trust her with your weather secrets.
Would they be uploading all that weather data to the cloud? Yes, we've got a bonus.
If that gets a point, I will walk. You cannot give that a point, dude. Are you crazy?
She's giving me a point.
That is a joke.
At the end,
listen,
that is an absolute shout, genuinely.
Listen, the now show would kill for stuff like that.
You must have had people when you were teaching that would just be naughty to see how far they could push you, and you keep on punishing them, wouldn't they? Well, I'm watching these points rack up now. Tragicomically, this is the news that the BBC is now offering members of the public the chance to contribute to corporation weather forecasts via the new Weather Watchers initiative. This might not be so bad, given that the BBC has ended its contract with the Met Office and all of our current weather forecasters are now technically unemployed members of the public. In other words, the BBC has handily subverted the idea of a forecast by instead asking members of the public to send in weather information after the weather has happened. All I'll say is, please send your stuff to the right place. The last thing we want is Jeremy Corbyn standing up at Prime Minister's questions and saying, I've had a letter from Pauline in Birkenhead who says, well, it's certainly cold in my garden. I sent them some great photos of fog before realising I had the lens cap on. I sent them some other great photos of fog before realising I was at an Occupy demonstration and being CS gassed. Groucho Marx said, I'd never join any club that would have me as a member. I have a similar principle, which is that I'd never join any club that's clearly a load of time-wasting BBC horseshit. 2 points to Romish. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting they'd like to share? Jeremy?
Yep. This was spotted in the British Museum by Alex Chatwin, and the text read, these figures are made of unfired clay. Although very crude, two of them certainly represent males. The third is either female or has lost a small piece of clay.
Rebecca.
I've got one from the Exmouth Journal that was sent in by Owen Jones. Further to a human skull being found in an East Devon skip, users of Exmouth's recycling centre are being asked to think carefully about what they throw away.
Camilla.
This is from Trevor Robinson in Cornwall, who spotted this review on TripAdvisor. It comes from the Icelandic Phallological Museum. Good, but smaller than I imagined.
Ramesh.
Ben Millinchip from Putney sent this. He received the message from his insurance company regarding his replacement phone. Dear sir, we are writing in regards to your insurance claim and are pleased to advise you that our technical team have completed the inspection of your phone and found it to be repairable. However, we have so far been unable to establish contact with you by phone to inform you of this.
Thank you. And now let's take a look at the final scores, which are Jeremy and Rebecca have 10, and so too do Camilla and Ramesh. We'd like to dedicate this programme to our friend, the much-loved and respected Radio 4 announcer Peter Donaldson, who died this week. We leave you with some of his most memorable contributions to the news quiz.
We start with a sign seen on Ward Street, Guildford, read by Peter Donaldson.
Due to roadworks, these toilets are not operational. Please use the pavement on the other side.
Here's a cutting from the Evening Standard, read by Peter Donaldson.
A lucky motorist escaped unharmed when an 18-ton lorry fell on his car from a bridge. One passerby did suffer slight injuries, although this was due to running into a wall as he fled the accident.
We launch round three with this small ad in the Yorkshire Post.
Successful businessman, widower, aged 44, usual trappings, non-smoker with varied interests, seeks affectionate, understanding female to shave the enjoyable things of life.
We start with an item from a local church news sheet, read by Peter Donaldson.
The sermon for this morning, Jesus Walks on Water. The sermon for tonight, Searching for Jesus.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Jeremy Hardy, Rebecca Fund, Camilla Long and Ramesh Ranganathan. In the chair was Miles Jupp and the news was read by me, Corrie Corfield. The chair's script was written by Gareth Gwynne, James Kettle and Tom Neenan, with additional material by Liam Byrne and Jenny Collier. The producer was Richard Morris, and it was a BBC Radio comedy production.